started. We have today, of course, our own Chris Springman presenting a paper on valuing attribution and publication intellectual property that he has done with either Chris Buccafusco and Zachary Burns or more. It's not clear.
Well, there's a whole bunch of people involved in a bunch of experiments. I'm going to go a little broader and not just talk about this paper, but talk about the research. Generally, and I'm going to do this a little differently, so we're going to have a new format for this. I'm just going to mouth a bunch of platitudes, and I'll ignore your objections at the end, and hopefully this will...
So I'll keep the cue. If it's not going well, at 12:50, I'm going to push the button, and there will be a very loud buzzer going off. Now, we're going to have a test
of my Lord.
Emergency broadcast system at 12:50 that will interrupt us.
So Chris and I, several years ago, were thinking about doing some behavioral economics experiments in intellectual property, and we zeroed in on a very old set of experiments on something called the endowment effect. So you're probably familiar, most of you, with these experiments. In their early form, the researchers would take a bunch of students, they'd pair them up, they'd distribute them around the room. For each pair, they'd give one student in the pair a coffee mug, and they'd say to that student, how much would you accept to transfer the coffee mug to the person sitting next to you? They'd say to the person sitting next to you, how much would you pay to get the coffee mug, right? So people essentially know the coffee mug's worth about $5, say, a pretty good information on the value of the coffee mug. And, you know, economists would say, operating in the rational choice framework, at least they would a while ago, that people have pretty good information about the value of the mug. The buyer would be willing to pay anything up to about $5, and the seller would be willing to accept anything above $5. The parties would start out pretty closely. You'd expect to see some deals. Right now, of course, people value things idiosyncratically, so there might or might not be deals in a particular potential transaction, but over the run of transactions, you'd expect to see some deals because people start relatively close together if they have good information about the underlying value of the good. That doesn't turn out to be what happens. So people have good information about the retail price of the mug. The buyers act more or less the way economists would expect. They report a willingness to pay of about $5, a little bit lower than $5 in most experiments. And the sellers act in a way that is a little bit unexpected. So they report a willingness to accept that typically is above what the rational choice figure would be, which suggests that the parties to these transactions start out actually further apart from one another in their valuation of the good than you would expect. That suggests that there'll be fewer transactions over the run of transactions than you would expect. That means that markets will clear at a lower level of output than you would expect because they'll have to invest more in negotiation to get to a meeting point in the middle, right? So this is a little bit troubling. Psychologists and behavioral economists label this the endowment effect, but that's just a label. Nobody really knows what's going on, right? There have been a bunch of explanations proposed, none really ever definitively established. One explanation, for example, is that people who have the mugs ab initio, they regret the potential loss. So they think, oh, you know, I like this mug, and if I alienate it, I'm going to feel regret. And so they're demanding to be compensated in advance for that anticipated regret. It turns out there's some further studies on whether that anticipated regret actually eventuates. It turns out, no, there's pretty quick hedonic adjustment to the loss of the mug. And this is true even with respect to things that people find more valuable, like mugs, for example, that they're awarded for good performance on a test in school, or NBA playoff tickets, things that they really worked hard to get. They tend to adjust to their loss fairly quickly. So this regret aversion seems to be playing a role, but maybe a role that is a little bit of a cognitive error. There are other explanations for this. So you can imagine if people like themselves, they tend to maybe like the things that they own. They see that as an extension of themselves, and so they tend to value the mug a little bit higher because it's imbued with their personality. Now, I have a hard time imagining how a mug is imbued with somebody's personality, but I have a pretty easy time imagining how a painting that somebody does is imbued with their personality. So Chris and I thought, well, you know, we looked at all these studies, and one thing we didn't see is we did not see anybody doing these studies with not things that people were simply given, but things that people made, right? So what would happen if you did the study, instead of doing it with a mug, you did it with a poem, right? So this was Greg Mitchell's great idea. We thought we were going to do this initially with digital photographs, which involved a nightmare of allowing students to roam the campus with digital cameras and violate people's privacy. So I had a meeting with Greg, and Greg said, what about haikus? And it was like, yes, haikus. Very easy to teach people how to write haikus. So we had students come in. We taught them how to write haikus. We ran an experiment with students running haikus. And we had a hypothesis. Actually, we had two hypotheses, and we didn't really know what to make of it. So one hypothesis. So in these creativity, in these endowment effect experiments, you see people transacting over coffee mugs. Nobody really cares about coffee mugs. People care a lot about the poems that they write, or maybe they care more than, anyway, they care about the coffee mug. And so to the extent that they anticipate regret from alienating it, maybe the gap between buyers' willingness to pay and sellers' willingness to accept would be higher. So you'd have greater endowment effects for things that you make rather than things that you simply endowed with. But there was a rival hypothesis, which went something like the following. So coffee mugs are rivalrous, right? Unless you're really close to somebody, a coffee mug is rivalrous. Poems are non-rivalrous, right? When I sell a poem, I typically don't sell the poem. I don't divest myself of the poem lock, stock, and barrel. I divest myself of some rights in the poem, right? Or a copy of the poem. This is a non-rival form of property. At least, you know, now that we have Xerox machines, it's a non-rival form of property. And so maybe the endowment effect has something to do with rivalry, and if you remove rivalry from the transaction, maybe the endowment effect goes away. So we did an experiment with poems, and we found that actually it's the first hypothesis that seems to bear out. There was a gigantic gap between what buyers were willing to pay and what sellers were willing to accept. And let me tell you how we simulated a non-rival transaction, which is we didn't have people transfer copies of the poem, but we made the poem an entrant in a contest. And we said to people, okay, so there's a $500 prize, there's 10 people in the contest, how much are you willing to pay to have your chance of winning transferred to a willing buyer? And we said to the buyers, how much are you willing to pay to have this poet's chance of winning transferred to you? So we treated the poems as essential potential revenue streams, like poems in a better world might be, right? We had people report their willingness to accept and willingness to pay based on that, and we saw gigantic gaps in valuation, 3-to-1. Gaps in valuation, we thought, well, maybe that's because the poets are enormously over-optimistic. So we said, in a different round of the experiment, we said, okay, we're not having a contest now. Now we're just having a lottery. These poems are just lottery tickets. So some of the endowment effect went away, but not all of it. About 2/3 of it went away, but some remained. And this roughly tracks some endowment effect studies we've seen where people realize endowment effects, even in stuff like lottery tickets that has a mathematically predictable return. Okay, so the next thing we did is we decided, okay, so these were just people, they were people off the street that we recruited to come in and write poems. You know, they're not really creators. They're creating poems because we're paying them. Let's do something a little bit better, a little bit more ecologically valid. Let's actually recruit people who create for a living or who want to. So this is the experiment I want to tell you about first. We went to Chicago and we recruited students at the Art Institute in Chicago, painting students who were getting their MFAs. And we held two painting shows where we had them paint, we had them actually enter medium-sized paintings. We had some standards for how big the paintings were so that they were roughly comparable one to another. We had them enter medium-sized paintings into two painting contests. And we said to them, okay, so there's $1,000. It was, how much was the prize? Geez, I'm getting old. It was a $100 prize. There are 10 of you in the contest. How much would you accept to have your chance of winning the prize transferred away to a willing buyer, we said to the painters. And then we recruited some students who were buyers, and we said, how much would you pay to have this painting's chance transferred away to you, right? And then we had a third silo. We had a group of students we recruited, and we called them owners. And we lied to them. We were given permission to lie to them. And we said to them, okay, here's a painting. It's yours. Now that you've been endowed with this painting, how much would you take to have the painting's chance of winning the prize transferred away to a willing buyer? And here was our hypothesis, that the creators would demand more to have their chances transferred away than the owners, the mere owners would demand, the people we lied to, and that both the creators and the owners would demand more than the bidders were willing to pay to have a particular painting's chance of winning transferred away. And lo and behold, we got that. And we got that in spades. So we got the painters demanding roughly $75 to have a 1 in a 10 chance of winning 100 transferred away. We got the owners demanding significantly less, about $41, to have a 1 in 10 chance of 100 transferred away. And we had the buyers willing to pay about 17 and change. Now, the buyers are acting much closer to the rational level, but the rational level is, of course, 10 on average, right? And so why are the buyers acting a little bit irrationally, too? We talked to them afterward, and they basically said, so we attach some significance to you showing us a particular painting, even though we could see all the paintings. We did attach some significance to you showing us one, and so we thought there was a somewhat greater chance than 1 in 10 that it would win. We didn't think that was a problem because to a great extent that understates the significance of our results. That tends to make the study more conservative, but that is an artifact of the study's design. In any event, what does this represent? So the gap between buyers and owners represents the endowment effect, right? It's a replication of dozens of studies that show an endowment effect, that is a tendency of owners of property to factor their ownership into the way they think of the property's value. What we, I think, have contributed here is that this gap, right, which has never been seen before, which we call the creativity effect, suggests that there's something going on, right, that's inherent in creativity that causes this gap between buyers and sellers and transactions to grow, right, that makes it more difficult to get these transactions, that makes more negotiation needed to close the gap. Again, this isn't to say that deals in intellectual property don't happen. They happen every day. But what this suggests is they happen at a somewhat higher cost than we might otherwise think, that markets structured by property rights in this way clear at a somewhat lower level of output than we might think otherwise. Okay, so why is this happening? So we designed our protocol to try to figure out what was motivating this. And there are some potential explanations here. One explanation, which turned out to drive a lot of this, is that just like nobody thinks they're a bad driver, nobody thinks they're a bad painter, especially if they happen to be getting an MFA in painting. So if you talked to our painters and said, well, what are your chances of winning the contest? On average, they said they had a 52.8% chance of winning the contest. 1 in 10. Okay, so someone's going to be right. But everyone can't be right. Mathematically, that's not possible. So wild overestimation of chances of winning the contest. And you can see that this varied in a way that was significant from what the owners thought was likely to happen and from what the buyers thought was likely to happen. Probability, if you do the regressions here, drives these results more than any other factor. Also contributing is anticipated regret, right? Buyers anticipate much lower levels of regret if they fail to obtain the winning chance than sellers anticipate if they alienate the winning chance. And the level of alienation or regret anticipated by the painters is much higher than the level of regret anticipated by the other actors in this story. Now, of course, these questions, I take them with a grain of salt, because you ask someone, well, how much regret do you anticipate feeling when you transfer away a painting? And they kind of scratch their head and they give you an answer. But you know what? That's how people price things, too. They scratch their head and they give you an answer. So to some extent, you know, these are feelings that they're giving us. But, you know, their feelings do, in fact, count. Okay. So I'll talk about possible implications for the IP law later. But let me talk to you about the experiment that we reported in the paper here, and then I'll give you some late-breaking news on this, which I think is exciting. So I was talking about this last experiment to people, and Chris Buccafusco was as well. And the reaction we'd get overwhelmingly would be, oh, that's interesting and, you know, maybe valuable, but your protocol did not allow people to think about the prospect of publication. And if you think about painters or poets or journalists, what do they want? They want to get their work out there, right? They want to have their work published. And so the prospect of publication, and especially publication with their name on it, publication with attribution, would tend to vitiate or perhaps even eliminate these endowment and creativity effects that you claim to have found. So Chris and I thought, okay, that's a really good point. Let's test it. So we designed a protocol that had three conditions, right? So it was a protocol like what we had before, only it broke up into three conditions. So in condition one, there was a contest, this time involving digital photographs. We got a grant, so we were able to enormously up the prize. The prize is now $1,000. There are 100 people in the contest, so the expected value is 10, right? And if they win the contest, right, they win a $1,000 prize, and we have the same structure where we ask photographers, what are you willing to accept to transfer your chance of winning away? Condition two is a little bit different. So in condition two, there's still a $1,000 prize, but if you make a deal, if you're the winning photographer and you've made a deal, you get to have your photograph published. And so the idea is, published without your name, but nonetheless published. The idea is we thought, well, if they value publication, even without attribution, they'll lower their willingness to accept in the hopes of getting a deal, right? Because they value publication. And the extent to which they lower their willingness to accept is a measure of how much they value publication. So condition three, publication with name. So now you'll get publication of your photograph with your name on it. And again, if they if they value publication with their name on it, they'll lower the willingness to accept in the interest of getting a deal so that they can get their publication out there. So our hypothesis, right, is that if they value publication and reputation, willingness to accept will be higher in cash and publication, and then publication willingness to accept will be greater than publication plus name. We were a little doubtful in some ways about what would happen with publication because we thought it was possible that people would get annoyed by the idea of publication without their name on it, and so it might go the other way. It turns out that we were right about that, although this data is a little bit surprising. So we have two samples. We have an MTurk sample and we have a meetup, what we call the meetup PDN sample. So what were we trying to do here? So MTurk is Amazon's Mechanical Turk. It's a subject recruitment service and you just get people from all over the world, but we restricted it to people in America. We were worried about English proficiency. It's an imperfect proxy, but we restricted it to people whose English was first language and lived in America. So these are ordinary people who don't do digital photographs for a living. They're just snap shooters. On the other hand, we recruited a bunch of professional and advanced amateur photographers through photography affinity organizations like the Charlottesville Photography Initiative and the Photo District News, which is the biggest publication for professional photographers. And so here's what we got. These graphs are a little hard to see, but compared to cash only and publication, publication with name, willingness to accept fell by a statistically significant amount. Now, it fell, right, if you gave people the opportunity to have their name published on the photograph, but it didn't eliminate the creativity effect. It diminished it by about 25%, but didn't eliminate it. Similar results with the professional advanced amateur photographers. Publication with name causes a statistically significant diminution in the amount demanded and willingness to accept, but again, it doesn't vitiate the entire effect. It reduces it by a little bit more than 25%, reduces it nonetheless, right? So, conclusion, it's helpful to have publication with name. It's not a panacea, but it's certainly helpful. And this has, I think, a very strong legal implication. So we're kind of alone in the world in not giving creators rights, default rights to attribution. So if you go to France and you create a photograph, you have a default right, if it's published, to have your name on it. In America, you don't. You have to negotiate for it. Now, lots of people on both sides of the kind of IP ideological divide agree that we should install into American law an attribution right because, of course, that's what people want. Our results suggest we definitely don't want to do that, right? Because by making people negotiate over attribution, not giving it to them as a default, but by making them negotiate over it, you bring them closer together. You shrink the tendency of markets like this, structured by property rules, to produce widely divergent initial valuations. So we did a little bit of work to try to test that directly. And let me just end with a little bit of data. So we had a new protocol where we had people upload digital photographs, and we told them that their photographs were going to be looked at by a graphic designer. And the graphic designer was going to choose one of five photographs. Right? The graphic designer would use the photograph he or she chose in a contest, an ad design contest. The prize would be $200. So your photograph is going to be one of the five that the graphic designer looks at. What do you demand in terms of payment, right, to have the graphic designer use your photograph if the graphic designer chooses it? Okay, so in condition one, the graphic designer can use your photograph, no right of attribution. Right? So you name a willingness to accept. And then we ask, well, what would you demand if, in fact, he gave you attribution, right? And you name another willingness to accept, and you expect it, of course, to be lower, because now you're getting attribution, so you might be willing to accept less because the attribution has a positive value. Condition two, right, we start with the default right in the photographer being to have attribution. We say, okay, so they're going to look at five digital photographs. One of them will be yours. If they use yours, you'll get it published with attribution. How much would you accept to have that done, right? And so they name a figure. And then we say, the graphic designer may not want to give you attribution. How much would you accept if you don't get attribution, right? So we'd expect the value to rise. Now, we have some, I think, really interesting data on this, which I'll just show you briefly. So condition one, the attribution is the default. That's my co-author. Attribution is the default pleasant guy. So they start with no right to attribution. There's 206 subjects in the experiment in this condition. They report a WTA, that is a willingness to accept, of 40.17 with attribution, and a willingness to accept without attribution of 54.94. So if you take attribution away from them, they have it as a default, and you take it away from them, they want a lot more. This is quite significant statistically. They want a lot more if you take it away from them, right? Whereas if you don't give it to them in the first place, so look at condition two, no default of attribution, 214 subjects in this condition, they report a WTA of without attribution of 42 and change, and then with attribution, they lower it marginally. So they're willing to lower it a little bit to gain attribution. But if you give it to them in the first place, they jack up their price a lot to lose it. And what does that suggest? The insight here is that the right to attribution, like any other property right, is one to which an endowment effect attaches if you give it to them as an initial default. So don't give it to them as an initial default. Make them negotiate for it, because if you give it to them as an initial default, it widens the gulf. It widens the pricing gulf between buyers and sellers. Okay, so that's where we are. I'm pretty excited about this. We'll see. You know, law reviews probably won't care because it's got numbers. But I'm hoping there's a chance. I'll stop there.